The opinions expressed in this program reflect only those of the participants and are not necessarily those of the sponsors, management, or staff of WTBQ Radio or FST Broadcasting Corporation. WTBQ.
Well, good morning, everyone. This is Sandy Cassesi. I am the president and CEO of Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties. Somebody told me that I got my title wrong last month, which is kind of funny. I've only been in this particular role for about 7 months. And you'd think I'd be used to the title, but to be perfectly honest with you, I think I've said this before, I'd like to change my title from Chief Executive Officer to Chief Optimist. So I'll do that on the air today. So lots to talk to you about today. I really want to get right to it. I'm going to start with some really good news. And I know that Taylor shared this with the audience this morning, but it's such good news, we're going to share it again. So as I've mentioned on the show before, hospice is a really highly regulated industry. We have to abide by federal regulations that are called conditions of participation. And, you know, they focus on a lot of things. In part, they focus on patient rights, improvements in outcomes, and strong quality improvement programs. So we're constantly working to ensure that not only the patient, but their family members and any caregivers that they have are included in what we call the treatment plan. And one of the ways that we measure our success in this area is a mandatory survey that goes out to families and caregivers when a patient passes away. So this is mandated by Medicare. So the survey is called the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. We call it CAPS. And this is not optional. It's designed in such a way that all hospices in the entire country have to engage an outside company to administer the survey so that it's truly impartial. So at Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties, we partner with a company called Strategic Healthcare Programs. And they have more than 1,000 hospice providers nationwide. And here comes the good news. Last week, we learned that we were recognized as a superior performer for achieving an overall caregiver and family satisfaction score that ranked, are you ready for this, in the top 20% of all eligible clients in the entire country, and that was for the 2022 calendar year. So this marks the third time that our hospice has achieved this award. So we're just incredibly proud. Top performer means a lot to me. I should note that there were only three others awarded in New York State, two of which are on Long Island and the other in Western New York, and they serve quite a few fewer patients than we do, meaning it's a little bit more difficult for us to achieve this ranking. So I'll just end this portion by saying it's incredibly rewarding for us. Why? Because it comes directly from families and caregivers of our patients. And it is yet another way that we use data to constantly improve the care that we provide. So today, my congratulations go out to each and every single employee of our hospice, and of course, to those in the community who trust us with their care. I just took a breath. That was a long statement. So this morning, I would like to introduce you to my very special guest. Her name is Kim Warner, and she directs the social work program at Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties. Good morning, Kim.
Hello, Sandy. Good morning to you.
I'm happy to have you on the show. It's been a while, and you really are the epitome, if you ask me, of what's right in healthcare. As a social worker, you and your team impact the lives of so many people in our community, not just the patients and caregivers and families that we have the privilege of serving, but far beyond that. So I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit about your expertise and what you do at Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties.
Well, my role is to help the success of 15 social workers in the field and hospitals and nursing homes. Meet the needs of the people that we care about as patients and the families that care about them. And we do that in keeping our skills refined and having a bereavement program and meeting legacy needs in with any veteran or any other person who has accomplished much and benefit from life review.
You know, Kim, I think that social workers in general are kind of underrated, and certainly in hospice care, unless someone has had the good fortune to come in contact with you or one of your staff, I really don't think that most people understand just exactly how much support that you offer to everyone in the community. And I just like to say out loud that when we look at those family satisfaction scores that I was talking about, consistently, the social work department ranks incredibly high, often getting 100% satisfaction results because of the impeccable work that you do. So I personally want to say thank you. And to the listeners who are out there, take a minute, go to hospiceoforange.com and click through, and you'll see some of the extraordinary work that Kim and her team has done for our community. So let's get into it, Kim. You know, I know that we have a number of options for support groups. In fact, if you would like to talk about, you know, the many support groups that we provide to the community, and then we'll end up focusing on one in particular, which is the Thriving Families Grief Support Group. So can you talk about options for support?
Absolutely. Our commitment with our regulations and our commitment to the community is to provide bereavement care for 13 to 15 months after someone who you love dies. And we can do that in a variety of capacities. For those families who have been on our program, we can provide some individual counseling. We often bridge them to an acute care grief group that runs 8 consecutive weeks, talking about the common areas that we interact with in our lives when we're in acute grief and strategies to get through that time. And then we also then transition folks to what's called an integrated grief program, which is twice a month and really helps us 3 to 6 months in understanding how to live with that loss and how it pertains to feeling balanced in our grief and in managing all the other pressures in life. So we do that. We have day groups. We have evening groups. A total of 8 groups that are available to the community free of cost, as well as to the patients' families whom we are obligated and desire to make sure they get back up on their feet.
So, Kim, let's talk a little bit about that community support, because I'm not sure everyone realizes that our hospice has made this very strong commitment to make sure that the services that we provide that you were just talking about, be they bereavement services or counseling, you know, in general, they're available to anyone in our community who needs that assistance. Can you just give us some facts on that?
Of course. We have been able to, for years now, been open our bereavement support groups to the community who have had someone die in their life, and they're grieving and not necessarily connected to hospice, but we feel like grief is a common experience that we all walk, and our agency wants to support our community as much as possible. So those who are interested in the group call and talk to our bereavement counselor to see if one of the groups is a good fit or not, and then they are encouraged to participate to help their healing hearts as well.
You know, I kind of hearken back to the dark period known as the COVID pandemic, when your staff was really helpful to many groups in our community. I think back to some of the work that you did with various folks in nursing homes, and I'm talking about the staff in the nursing homes at this point who just had extraordinary grieving going on. And I just really want to, you know, emphasize the fact that, you know, yes, we provide end-of-life care, but really today let's focus on that grief process. It is so complicated. Wouldn't you agree, Kim?
It is, and it's very personalized, and it depends on the relationship you have with that person, the support that you have, the experience you've had with grief in the past. We help, you know, during COVID, we did move to virtual groups, and people were so interested in staying connected that they were very successful. We not only helped people in nursing homes, but we helped the Newburgh school system with children who were having real struggles with grief in their lifestyle. So our commitment to our community is really broad.
You know, there's such a thing called anticipatory grief, with I'm just not sure the average person has a working knowledge of that. Can you talk about that from your perspective as a social worker?
With our relationships, we know sometimes that people are ill, and we know that that illness is going to create death eventually, some point in our future. And as soon as we learn that, we start to experience the components of grief. We feel some sadness. We feel some shock. We feel some denial. We feel some anger. And those elements of emotion are starting to bubble up inside. And we have to, well, we don't have to, but it certainly is helpful to think about those feelings and start to process them with clinicians as you approach the disease process. So anticipatory grief happens to all of us, whether we like it or not. And acknowledging it and talking through it is very beneficial.
So I imagine that those kinds of conversations also go on with the patient themselves. In fact, I know they do. I recently received an email from someone in our community whose mom was dying, and the patient herself said, geez, why is this taking so long? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's a pretty common thing. And I know for a fact that your social work team was very instrumental in helping that patient with the anticipatory grief and concern about leaving family members behind. So I think, you know, this is something that we need to talk about more. And I'm really glad, you know, that you're adding some context to this idea that grief doesn't only take place after someone has a loss.
What we find is helping families talk about how they're going to take care of each other after the death, mm-hmm. what they're worried about in the absence of that person, and planning ahead together rather than kind of avoiding the topic is very helpful for families to prepare and to feel unified in that they can manage this trial together.
You know, Kim, I think you just used the operative word, which is planning, and we have talked about this on this show many, many times. Not only is it important in the, you know, day-to-day work that you do, but we also encourage people to have advance directives so that, you know, all of this is kind of plotted out in advance and people aren't in a panic when somebody is actually in the final stages of passing away.
Helping with decision-making, telling your the person who's going to die that I'm going to participate in these grief groups, this is what I'm going to do with your remains, this is how I'm going to remember you, these are the things you taught me that will stay with me forever. All of that conversation is very helpful and healing.
You know, as a caregiver myself, I cared for both of my parents. I fortunately took the advice of every hospice provider and did exactly what you just described. And, you know, we say often that you can't undo the death experience. The experience is what it is. And so we want so desperately for people to avail themselves of the services that we provide. And let's talk about this one in particular, the Thriving Families Grief Support Group. So a lot of words. Can you help us understand how the group came to be?
What we've acknowledged is that children very much are impacted on loss. And we know that children grieve differently than adults. And the adults who love them, surviving the death, want the best for the children. And education about how children grieve and encouraging them to grieve together rather than separately can help that family build unity in their experience.
We have a lot more to say on that subject. We're going to take a quick break. And Kim, when we get back, I want to talk about that education that you so aptly provide to our community.
Dear hospice family, my husband was given less than 6 months, and he was able to be here for 10.5 months. I think that was because of the care that was given to him by hospice.
Dear Hospice of Orange and Sullivan County, my family is so grateful for the care that hospice provided at the end of Mom's life.
I write this letter to give my thanks and gratitude to the people of hospice who were so understanding and caring in my family's time of need.
The Kaplan Family Hospice residence, it was like a breath of fresh air.
I know that God sent these wonderful people to us.
It was one of the best decisions we had ever made.
I think it lengthened his time on earth.
Call Hospice of Orange and Sullivan, providing generations of care in your community. There are others. Make sure to ask for us by name. Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties, your choice. Does matter.
I'd just like people to find out about hospice while there was still time.
Hospice is a plan for living.
This is Zach Crux, sports director for WTBQ. Tune in every weekday morning to the Frank Truatt Morning Show to get the latest news, scores, and info about your favorite teams and players. That's every Monday through Friday on the Frank Truatt Morning Show right here on WTBQ. WTBQ.
Hi, we're back. This is Sandy Cassese, the CEO of Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties. I'm with my wonderful guest, Kim Werner. And if you tuned in a little late, we started the program today talking about the fact that our hospice, Hospice of Orange and Sullivan Counties, was recognized as a superior performer in caregiver and family satisfaction. And we ranked in the top 20% of all eligible hospices in the country for last year. Very exciting. And I truly believe that a large portion of gratitude goes to our social work team. And before the break, Kim and I were talking about the Thriving Families Grief Support Group. And Kim was talking about how, you know, there are really big differences in the way that children and youth in general express their feelings. And so, Kim, you have developed a very specialized curriculum for this support group. Tell us about your approach. I think it's important for the listeners to hear this.
Sure. The children are highly influenced by the adults around them and how they manage grief and how they model grieving and how they talk about the person that died or not. And so so often when a death occurs, the focus is on the children. We decided to create this program so the focus is on both the children and helping them identify emotions and how to manage emotions, and then also the adults who love those children and how they're managing and how do they raise grieving children. So it's a really a two-part series. One day is everybody and the second day is purely adults. The other thing we've done is we've had themes, and when COVID hit, we regrouped. And now we have a virtual program where we send a package of information to the family, encourage them to utilize the craft items within our program, really gets the children anticipating coming together and participating and showing each other how they express themselves through their craft work. It's quite successful. We're very happy to say that our series is set up for fall through late spring of 2024. This is open to the public. This is open to any family who would like to support children who are having a loss, whether it's right in their family or an extended member.
So, Kim, talk about the crafts, because I think we need to give some definition around that, because I think they're just absolutely incredible from what I've seen. And then if you could also talk about the support that we've received from our friends of hospice.
Oh, sure. Well, all of the materials that go into these packages are sponsored by the Friends of Hospice, and we're extremely grateful for that because it is the hands-on materials that the children get, very concrete things, and there's always a teddy bear or a cuddly in the package to give them some warmth and love. One of the, I'm going to explain two projects. One of the themes is anger, so we make sure that there's bubble wrap in there, and there's tissue boxes so that children can stomp when they're angry and tear paper when they're angry and express themselves in a very productive way and saying that anger is valid and true.
Wow.
Another craft is to create a paper plate on a stick, and it has two faces. One face is the face that everybody sees when you go to school and on the playground, and the other face is one that's of how we feel inside. And we have a lot of discussion about what happens with each expression and how both are true, and we want to validate that what we feel inside is really important.
I think every single art teacher in the community that's listening to this is probably applauding because it's such a successful vehicle for children to express their feelings. So I'm very happy about that. I really applaud you. So, you know, we know in this particular program that family involvement is just crucial. How about you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I find that children look up to the adult that's around them. So if the adult does not cry or express their grief in front of the child withholds and holds it inside, or they'll say, if I cry, I'm making my adult cry, and so I won't cry because I'm controlling that tears. And the education we provide is that we get the adult to say, oh no, I feel those feelings inside whether or not you're talking about it or not. So let's do this together.
Interesting. So, you know, I think it's important for the listeners to understand what a typical meeting would look like.
There's a theme each time. So say worry is the theme, and they come together online. We talk about what the word is. Does anybody know what that term means? We give them an education. We read them a children's book about worry. We make a craft about worry. We do sharing about what we have created about our worry, and then we do some self-care breathing techniques together, and always building how we take care of ourselves with whatever emotion we is the topic. So they very much enjoy the breathing techniques and the practice. And we've found that the resources in online are very in-depth to have a storybook reading and exercise like that. It's not just looking at a staff person, but really everybody participating in it. And one of the best parts I find about the virtual is the children don't feel like they're being looked at.
Interesting.
And so they're much more free to have their expressions come out.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you are saying that Zoom format that so many people, particularly adults, you know, have kind of had enough of really works in this particular situation. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It makes it more available time frame for the adult who's managing children and probably a job in life and the dinner hour kind of thing, as well as we're able to reach way up into Sullivan County and over to the end of Port Juris of Orange and up into Walden. There's a very ability to reach more children and not have travel be a hindrance.
That's good because that can be an impediment. I guess the question that our listeners are probably asking is, how do you maintain confidentiality?
They do sign consents of confidentiality. We do have settings we use a business account that's already preserved with confidentiality. and we do not allow any interaction on the chat.
Good.
So that there is very much personal safety.
Good. I like the fact that those safeguards are in place. It's particularly important, I think, in this particular instance. So, Kim, you know, one of the things that we try to do in hospice is tell stories. It really paints a picture. And I'm hoping that you can talk about maybe a particular success story that you can recall in the time that we've been doing these programs.
Well, there's one child in particular that came immediately to my mind when you asked that question. She was a young girl whose brother died a terrible swimming accident in front of her. And she was a part of the program for 2 years. The first year, she would not utter her brother's name, nor would she really speak about the death. She participated rather passively, listening to the other children and watching. She had her parents right alongside who were extremely heavy grieving. They had individual support. The value of bringing children together is to reduce that sense of loneliness. And so this child, by the second year, was able to speak her brother's name, was able to talk about how much she loved him, and how much she enjoyed certain activities with him, which is a very healthy sign that she was recovering from the trauma and starting to integrate the love of her brother into her life.
My goodness, you know, that just further illustrates how grief is really a personal process, because I would imagine that in these groups you have people who are very chatty and very willing to express their feelings. And the story that you just told, I think, is emblematic probably of more, you know, folks who are dealing with grief than we even think of. So let's talk about the particulars. How does someone who's listening to this get involved?
Well, we have a bereavement support telephone extension that's monitored, and anyone who's interested in learning about this or exploring more about our adult or children's program would do so. So it's our main hospice phone number, 845-561-6111, and the extension to our bereavement counselors is 232. A second way to learn about our program is to go to our agency's website, and there is quite a bit of information about the bereavement program and the care we provide of participants, and gives more details about each group.
You know, Kim, I want to personally thank you for the work that you and your team are doing in the community, and I look forward to continuing this conversation soon. Have a wonderful day, and to all who are listening, please reach out. We have so many resources for you.